The Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley.
Oh, yeah!
On 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader.
What is this?
We're talking Notre Dame football, the NFL, the Cubs, and more.
Oh, yeah, I like this idea.
The Leprechaun Lunch.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
With Sean Stiers.
All you do is dribble.
I have to dribble. If I give it to you, you just shoot.
And Evan Sharpley.
You're a chucker. You chuck.
If it's happening in sports.
Bumble!
We're talking about it.
Flag on the play.
Now your hosts. Sean Stiers and former Irish quarterback. Evan Sharpley.
How are you today, Evan Sharpley? It's a beautiful day again in Michiana.
It is. I've had a stressful 24 hours.
Uh-oh.
Well, it's my phone for some reason didn't want to work for about 24 hours. I was a reset on it, so I've been without a phone, calendar. It's weird. You're kind of connected to those things, huh?
Oh, I mean, especially today in the world we live in general, but you know, now with just everything that's gone on in the last almost 3.5 months now, it seems like even more so we're more connected to those things. So you're absolutely right. It's like, what do you do without your phone for 12 hours?
I honestly didn't know what to do. It was weird. And then I had to try to trace my steps on if I had any specific things. Now, I obviously wouldn't have forgotten noon because of our show.
Right.
But there were a couple other appointments. I was like trying to rack my brain on where I had to be.
Where am I supposed to be? Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we are supposed to be here right now. As you said, it is noon, and we are here every Friday, Sean and Sharpley, on the Leprechaun Lunch, and we're presented by Bud Light Seltzer, light and refreshing with 4 fruit flavors, just 100 calories, 2 grams of carbs, less than a gram of sugar, Bud Light Seltzer and mango, strawberry, lemon, lime, and black cherry. We've got some Notre Dame football conversation that we're going to get to in a little bit, and Evan is already, he was flying off with some hot takes when we were talking right before the show started. I had planned on talking some baseball later in the show, Evan, but I don't even know if I want to.
It's just going to make you sad, that's all.
I know. We thought we were close to a deal just a couple of days ago. And
well, you mean you thought we were close.
Yes. I'll tell you this, based on what we were talking about on Wednesday's Budweiser Sports Beat, I know Darren Pritchett thought that we were very close, and I kept saying, you might want to tamp the brakes on that because
little Lee Corso, not so fast, my friend.
Not so fast, my friend. That's absolutely right. So we'll get to some of that football talk for sure coming up in a little bit. But first, a couple of different things going on regarding Notre Dame. One is going to happen in less than 30 minutes. The athletic department and the Notre Dame football program is gathering at 12:30 today for a recognition of and celebrating Juneteenth. The event will serve as a symbol of the next step in leading the Notre Dame community to what it's calling its best version of itself and to celebrate the Black Lives Matter movement by keeping it in the forefront of conversations and committing to learning how it is impacting our world. The gathering is going on at the Irish Green between the DeBartolo Performing Arts Center and Angela Boulevard. It's going to include an opening prayer from defensive lineman Myron Tongavaloa Amosa, words from defensive lineman Dalen Hayes and offensive lineman Max Siegel, as well as head football coach Brian Kelly. They're going to be wearing black shirts, and they're going to take a unity walk across campus for equality as well afterwards. So that is going on. And it is scheduled to start at 12:30 today over at Notre Dame. So great day for that, and a great day for some unity as hopefully things in our country begin to settle down, but also progress forward after everything that's happened over the last 3 weeks or so.
Yeah, well, I think at this point now, right, it's, what are going to be the positive actions moving forward? And I know Notre Dame has done a great job of, I think, coming together and doing some different peaceful protests, and this is an example of one of those things.
Absolutely. And also, an announcement today from Notre Dame and the basketball program. Notre Dame men's basketball is going to travel to Washington, D.C. January 18th next year, 2021. It's going to be Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and they're going to play Howard University on that day. The triple marked the first road game for Notre Dame men's basketball against one of the country's historically black colleges and universities. And a quote from Mike Bray, we have been looking for the best way to fulfill our game contract with Howard, and this seemed to be like the perfect fit. As our program searched for the best way to remain active participants in the push for social change, a visit to one of our nation's top HBCUs on Martin Luther King Jr. Day will provide an incredible educational experience for student athletes, coaches, support staff, and the university. The game's going to be played at Howard's Burr Gymnasium. So that's a pretty cool thing Notre Dame basketball is going to be doing, Evan.
Yeah, I mean, I think that with everything that's going on in the nation, you know, we're going to continue to see, and I'm grateful that, you know, that Notre Dame is one of the schools that is being proactive about this. And, I think the biggest thing was coaches and support staff just listening to players and getting feedback about, you know, how things are, and being a student athlete at Notre Dame, I get it. You know, I have a ton of former players and friends that were African American, and you know, I can't say I know what they experienced growing up. And one story I told, I remember David Grimes, a teammate of mine. I remember going to Detroit and throwing with him, and you know, for me coming from a small, primarily all white town in Marshall, Michigan,
right.
You know, it was kind of a wake up call for me outside of that little bubble. But, you know, to come together with, you know, a group of 80 guys, you know, it was really special for me to have those bonds and that brotherhood that we built, inside those doors. And, you know, with any family, there are disagreements, but I think we learned a lot from each other. And, you know, certainly I think prepared me post athletics too, you know, within the working world as well.
Notre Dame and Howard are also announcing, along with this game that's going to take place January 18th, an initiative to support When We All Vote, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that is on a mission to create participation in every election and close the race and age voting gap by changing the culture around voting. And I'm reading this from the Notre Dame release: harnessing grassroots energy and through strategic partnerships to reach every American. So that's going to be part of this game. Notre Dame at Howard University, January 18th, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. So again, a very cool thing, because initially they had announced this game was going to be canceled. It was supposed to take place this December, and then they were going to move it back to Notre Dame. So now this is still going to be at Howard, but it is going to be on a very important day, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, January 18th. The tip-off time and all that stuff still to be announced, but that is coming. So very cool stuff going on with Notre Dame. All right, let's get into some football, Evan Sharpley. Bruce Feldman of The Athletic wrote a piece this week titled One Tweak Away: Contenders Who Could Make an LSU Type Leap in 2020. And Feldman starts by citing last year's LSU team. Nobody pegged them for a national championship contender at this time a year ago, but Ed Orgeron hires Joe Brady as his new offensive coordinator. The Tigers and Joe Burrow take off. They win a national championship. Burrow wins a Heisman Trophy. So what Feldman is trying to do in this piece is figure out if there is another top 10 caliber team primed to make a similar leap in 2020. So this is actually going to get a little long-winded, but I'll read you what he says in his piece, and then we can kind of go from there. He says, the Irish were good on offense under former offensive coordinator Chip Long, ranking number 29 in yards per play last year. Long's personality, though, wore on a lot of folks inside the Irish program, and Brian Kelly made the big change. Young Tom Rees, the former Irish quarterback, had a strong audition as the play caller in the Camping World Bowl romp over Iowa State. Rees earned the promotion to OC along with Lance Taylor, who helped him in putting together the game plan for the bowl game as the new run game coordinator. John McNulty, a veteran former OC who worked with Rees in San Diego, that's with the Chargers, he'll bring more seasoning. Rees already had a strong connection with the players, and that should help with the transition. Word is, Rees is an excellent communicator that figures to be good for Ian Book, who was quite good last season, 34 touchdown passes, 6 interceptions, but needs to be sharper away from South Bend to take that next step. Rees's bond with defensive coordinator Clark Lee helping the young offensive coordinator get more dialed into the way defensive coaches think should prove beneficial. Taylor, who spent three seasons with David Shaw at Stanford, knows all about the virtues of being committed to the ground game. That figures to be more of an emphasis in this new iteration of Brian Kelly's offense. As good as Notre Dame has been up front, at times the Irish rushing attack has faded in games they've lost over the past few seasons. Also, it'll be interesting to see how they use dynamic freshman Chris Tyree. The 192-pounder has got burst like, unlike any back ND has had the past couple seasons, and is similar to another back Taylor had around Stanford, Bryce Love. So, those are the points Bruce Feldman makes in his article in The Athletic. He says odds of having a breakout offense are 25-1 for Notre Dame. So, Evan, let's kind of jump into this a little bit. He mentions commitment to the run game and all that. So, what do you think about that aspect of things?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think he lays out a good blueprint, you know, for success if Notre Dame is going to make a big jump. You know, I think right now I'm still in that, you know, that 10-11 win range, which is still a fantastic season. I mean, we're talking about, a team that pretty much dominated every team they played last year in LSU in a tough conference. I don't know if Notre Dame's going to be at that type of level. But if they are going to have success, and even if they are going to win 10-11 games, and, you know, who knows if they play well and they stick to, I think this blueprint sounds like it would lead to some success, you know, in beating Clemson potentially in early November. You've got, you know, a run game right now with a lot of question marks. You've got a number of guys, a transfer, a talented incoming freshman, and then some names that have been in the program but really, you know, haven't done a lot at this point. But, you know, the good part of it is they have pretty much their entire offensive line returning. So if you're reading the tea leaves, there's a chance to be able to control the line of scrimmage and ultimately run the football with some success, regardless really of who that running back is. So, you know, if they're able to establish the run, I mean, any team that has success, if they're able to do that, it certainly does help. You know, it helps the pass game. But if you look at LSU's blueprint last year, was somebody that threw 60 touchdown passes. So that works as well.
No, absolutely. And I want to kind of let's stick with the running back theme a little bit. Then we'll come back to a couple other of Bruce Feldman's points, because on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat recently, we talked about Chris Tyree and what this looks like. And the question that we asked, as Darren found some prominent freshmen in Notre Dame history, Alan Pinkett ran for 532 yards in 1982 as a freshman, Julius Jones 375 in 1999, Darius Walker had a really nice season, 786 yards and 7 touchdowns in 2004. And then in 2015, you've got a guy like Dexter Williams, who had C.J. Procise and Josh Adams in front of him, ran for just 81 yards. So we're still trying to figure out how Chris Tyree figures into the equation in the backfield. What is your best guess for maybe what that looks like for the freshman who, as Feldman points out, has a lot more burst than a lot of the backs that Notre Dame has seen in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to come in and be an impact player, you know, day one. And certainly given COVID and where we are right now, I think it makes it, you know, all the more difficult as far as coming in and understanding a playbook and protections. But when you have talent like that, you're going to hopefully find ways to still use it. I think for me right now, I'd say my ceiling, just because I'm probably being a little cautious, and again, because it's, you know, it's somebody coming in fresh, is an Alan Pinkett type year as kind of the high end. You know, over 500 yards, 5 touchdowns, and then a low end of like a Julius Jones, where you know, maybe as far as the number of carries, you know, a little bit lower, but kind of that 375 range. I think he's going to get some touches. I mean, with uncertainty, I think that breeds opportunity. But at this point, it's tough to go out on a limb and say, all right, you know, he's going to go off for 700 or 800 and, you know, double-digit touchdowns, because I think it's going to be a running back by committee, especially early on until they, you know, maybe settle into a little bit of a rhythm.
And with everything that we've talked about with an essentially kind of an accelerated fall camp, I would think that guys who have experience in the offense are probably going to get opportunities first. I mean, just because of everything, like last week we were talking about Brian Kelly talking about a shorter playbook and all these different things. So you've got guys like a guy like Tyree with all this talent and a newcomer like the grad transfer, Trevor Spates from Stanford, but not having the same familiarity. I don't know if like Spates' familiarity with Lance Taylor, if that helps anything when you talk about the coordination with Tom Reese and the run game and all that. But I would just think Jafar Armstrong, those guys at the top. And because when you look at all these different, the guys that we just talked about, Pinkett, Jones, Walker, it's not just them, but it's also what was the overall running back situation right at the time. Because this year, Tyree is one of six guys vying for time. Like, you look at Darius Walker with his 786 yards. He held the Notre Dame school record for rushing yards by a freshman until Josh Adams broke it in 2015. And so it's him and it's Ryan Grant. Grant ran for over 500 yards, but he missed three games that season with a hamstring injury. And then after that, it drops to Marcus Wilson for 138 yards. So it was primarily going to be Walker and Grant anyway. There wasn't necessarily a lot of depth there. There was some depth in some of these other yards. And so I think that obviously plays a big part of it as well. At the very least, though, as I've said, I would like to see Chris Tyree as a kick return guy and see what he can do there. Even if he's not getting a lot of reps in the backfield, he could still give the Irish a lot as a return guy potentially.
I like that idea. I can get on board with that.
Yeah, okay. All right. So at least we're on board on that, because we're going to disagree probably on some other stuff later on.
Sure, but, we do. That's okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's absolutely okay. It wouldn't be fun if we completely agreed on everything. So going back to Bruce Feldman's article from The Athletic, he mentions Tom Reese as an excellent communicator. So what part do you think that plays into turning the page offensively for the Irish this year and again, potentially being able to kick it to another gear?
Well, I mean, we can use the example of a guy like Clark Lee and what he's done for the defense, and really, you know, what Mike Elko brought too was, you know, being able to take maybe something complex and, you know, turn meat into milk so it's easier for these players to chew on, right, or digest, I guess, in this case. And I think, you know, I think Tommy does a great job with that. He obviously understands the offense. I mean, that was his MO as a player. Wasn't necessarily, you know, his incredible football skills. Right. But I think sometimes, you know, people undersell his ability. You know, granted, he wasn't a burner, but I think he was a very accurate passer and, you know, knew where the ball was going. But, you know, something that he brought to the table was he was going to get his team in the right play. And I think being able now as a coach to teach that to, you know, not only Ian Book, but the rest of the quarterback room is going to be very invaluable. But taking it one step further now too, as the coordinator and being able to immerse the entire offense in that knowledge base, you know, what am I looking for here? You know, down and distance, you know, tendencies that the defense may have, so that really it's not all on the quarterback's shoulders, as you have an entire offense then kind of looking for defense's weaknesses. I think that aspect of it, you know, it makes it very fun as an offense when instead of you reacting to what the defense does, you're kind of dictating how you would like to do things. So it's not reacting at the snap of the ball. It's, all right, we're going to give them the best play based on what the defense does. They're going to have to adjust to what we do.
And the other thing that Bruce Feldman brings up in this article that I hadn't really considered before, and I'm really interested to get your take on it. I'll go ahead and read the quote again. Reese's bond with defensive coordinator Clark Lee, helping the young offensive coordinator get more dialed into the way defensive coaches think should prove beneficial. What do you think about that aspect of it? That's something that that hadn't really even crossed my mind before.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you know, I know myself personally, you know, I would pick defensive coordinators' brains all the time. You know,
right.
I enjoyed that. Hey, you know, if we do this, what would you do? you know, how are we able to beat certain things that we see? So, you know, it I think it's unique if that's the case that, you know, there is this bond, you know, kind of developing between Clark Lea and Tommy Rees. You know, they seem on similar tracks as far as, you know, what they're doing within the coaching ranks. And I think, too, you know, they both have very similar styles as far as how they relate to players. It's less, you know, they'll get on guys, but it's more about a collective understanding versus, you know, I'm going to berate you because you made a mistake.
Yeah.
And I think you're seeing a pretty big shift across the board. Even at the high school level, to the college level, the pro level, where that is more of the case, where it's let's kind of work through this together, and maybe understand why you're not getting it versus just yelling because you don't get it.
So let's look at this from a backup quarterback situation now, because I think that is potentially a big concern if anything happens to Ian Book this season. So your answer to this next question can be either, neither, or both. Which Notre Dame quarterback has more pressure on them heading into the season, and maybe even heading into training camp, you could say? Sophomore Brendan Clark or true freshman Drew Pine? Either, neither, both.
I would say neither. I don't think there's really a lot of pressure on either guys. I hope they don't feel that way. You know, there should be good competition between the two of them. That certainly is the case. But, you know, what I'll say is I'm very confident with this quarterback room right now, even though, you know, you have two guys that haven't played. You know, I was a little more concerned a year ago. but I think at this point right now, I really like the style of play that Notre Dame is recruiting as far as the quarterbacks. They're guys that can spin the football. They have good athleticism and can extend plays. And now I think they're really complementing, you know, the way that they're running the offense around them. So, you know, they're true quarterbacks in the sense that there aren't any red flags about them being able to throw. And I think that, you know, as an offensive coordinator, and then at the top with Brian Kelly, I'm sure he rests a little easier knowing, well, we're not going to have the conversation of, do we need to change this guy's throwing motion? You know, they're coming in ready to throw already, and now it's just getting the mental side prepped and ready to go. So the physical things I'm not concerned about. It's just going to be, you know, how quickly do they acclimate to the playbook?
Well, and that's, so do you think that there is pressure, again, with the lost spring and everything else and the reps these guys would have had if they had gone through spring, is there pressure potentially on Tommy Rees to get one of these guys ready to be the backup if they're called upon?
Yeah, I mean, if there's, you know, if there's anything that they could take advantage of, and I'm not sure, you know, to what extent they were doing Zoom calls and things like that, is they should have had ample time to, you know, spend watching film and learning the playbook. But it doesn't, you know, the real thing is missed out on. So there's got to be a sense of urgency is what I'll say. You know, when you get into fall camp, I think everyone at this point should have confidence in Ian Book. You know, there may be a little rust the first couple of weeks, more timing than anything. But you're going to want to get some live reps for these younger guys because a lot of it for them could potentially be, you know, them seeing new things.
Does what we talked about last week, the fact that what would typically be training camp that are going to now be practices while classes are going on as well with the semester starting early, do you think that affects any of this, the ability to get more of that kind of work done for these kind of guys?
Well, for, you know, for a true freshman, possibly, because it is going to be, you know, kind of your first go at balancing athletics and academics at, you know, a pretty rigorous school. You know, and then you've got Brennan Clark, who's gone through a year. So, you know, I would say, just based on my experience, you know, Clark will probably be a little more acclimated in going through it now this time. But yes, you know, to answer your question, I think it will have an effect. But again, you know, we're talking about, you know, two guys that I think ultimately, you know, are going to really push each other to be the next starting quarterback in Notre Dame.
All right, we're going to take a timeout. We're going to come back. We're going to talk some more Notre Dame football. The conversation about it. Who could be Notre Dame's MVP, the Notre Dame football MVP in 2020. We talked about it on Sports Beat this week, and Evan Sharpley is going to come strong with a take on the guys who were on our list, the four guys that we've got on the list. So we're going to do that when we return. It is Sean and Sharpley and the Leprechaun Lunch. We're presented by Bud Light Seltzer, light and refreshing, four fruit flavors, mango, strawberry, lemon, lime, and black cherry, just 100 calories, 2 grams of carbs, and less than 1 gram of sugar. It is Bud Light Seltzer, and this is the Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley on Sports Radio 96.1 WSBT. Don't forget, this show presented by Bud Light Seltzer, light and refreshing, 100 calories, 2 grams of carbs, less than a gram of sugar. It is Bud Light Seltzer. Okay, Evan, so the conversation this week, who's going to be Notre Dame football's MVP in 2020? The three candidates that Darren Pritchett put up on the Sports Beat poll this week: quarterback Ian Book, wide receiver Kevin Austin, and rover Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah. You take issue with one of the candidates, it sounds like.
No, I don't.
Oh, well, that's what it sounded like at 11:59. I mean, come on.
Well, no, I was just reading the notes was all.
Oh, okay.
That's not actually how I feel.
Okay.
So, I mean, the odds-on favorite for me is Ian Book. You know, the ball is going to be in his hands the most. I think it would be, you know, it'd be his award to lose unless somebody just, you know, completely blows things up and goes
so
crazy. You know, over 3,000 yards last year, you know, 34-6, you know, didn't turn the ball over a ton. I think he can build off of that. You know, I think he can. And then, you know, Kevin Austin and really the whole wide receiver group, you know, we could kind of toss, you know, I guess all of them in there. Braden Lindsey being another guy potentially that could have a good year at the wide receiver position. I just really think with, you know, not a receiver coming back that is established and a veteran quarterback, I think you're going to see a very balanced passing attack where you could have three or four guys have quite a few receptions, but maybe not one guy who's kind of dominating, you know, a la Chase Claypool last year, the way that he finished. So, you know, I think that's kind of where I am. I think it'd be tough for a receiver to win it.
That's, I completely agree with that. As good as Kevin Austin is, like, if you look real, let's look real quickly at last year. Chase Claypool was the MVP. Ian Book was the Offensive Player of the Year. Khalid Kareem was Defensive Player of the Year. And Alohi Gilman was named Impact Player of the Year. And now a lot of times they sort of move these around, shuffle around. Okay, this guy's going to get this. This guy's going to get this. Claypool, very veteran guy, had over 1,000 receiving yards. You know, I think whether you want to call him the MVP or Book the Offensive Player of the Year, I think it would be very hard if Notre Dame is going to be that 11-win, 10-win team, whatever it happens to be. I think it would be very hard for Ian Book not to be the MVP by the time things are all said and done. And I agree with what you're saying about the receiving, because Claypool led Notre Dame with 66 catches last year. I don't think any Irish receiver even gets to 50 this year because of what you're talking about with all these newcomers and the fact that there's going to be, I think, so much talent across the board. The ball's going to be spread around quite a bit. What do you think? Do you think a receiver even gets to 50 catches?
I think, you know, I think someone may be close. you know, I think it'll be similar to kind of, you know, that 2018 year. You know, you had Miles Boykin at 59, Claypool at 50, Fink at 49.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say right now, no, I don't think anyone's gonna go over 50, but I think you're gonna see three or four guys that maybe, you know, that may be close.
Yeah. I completely agree. I think we're gonna have a handful of guys in that 40 or even 35 to 50 range, and then a couple more right behind it. Because then you throw in Tommy Trimble as well. He's not a receiver technically, but I think he's going to play a big part in the passing game. And there are all these different guys, and even a guy like Jordan Johnson, real talented freshman receiver. Is he going to emerge potentially at some point? And also a guy like Javon McKinley, because he had 11 catches for 268 yards last year. And this is another thing that we talked about this week on Sports Beat. So between McKinley, who had 11 catches for 268, and running back Sebo Flemister, who had 48 carries for 162 yards, which of those two guys do you think is more likely to increase his production this year?
I've got on that one, I mean, the thing for me, I think McKinley, I believe he has more in the tank than 11 catches.
Okay.
You know, 48 carries, you know, Sebo Flemister may, you know, end up getting more than that. But if they do go this running back by committee, you know, I think both of them are going to have the opportunity. But I'm going to go with McKinley on this just because I think he's going to catch more than 11 passes.
Okay. And maybe I should, you know, sort of qualify it as distinct, you know, production increase, not just, oh, is he going to have more than 11, you know, whatever. But I think Sebo Flemister kind of takes on that role that Deion McIntosh had a couple of years ago, where that was the Josh Adams year, where he kind of comes in late and they're closing out games, and, you know, like he did against Iowa State. We saw him do that, where he racked up some yards and carries in the fourth quarter against Iowa State. So I'm not saying that from the first through third and fourth quarter, Sebo is necessarily going to be the guy, but I could see him taking on a role like that where his production substantially increases as a result. I just don't know. I mean, both of these position groups, running back and receiver, have a lot of bodies there, and how it's all going to get sorted out over the course of the season is
that's why it's such a good question because there are a lot of guys. I mean, there's somebody we may be talking about that may kind of burst onto the scene. Who knows?
Right. So let's go back to the MVP conversation. Ian Book, Kevin Austin, Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah were the three candidates. So what do you think about Owusu-Koramoah as an MVP candidate? I think it's like when you're looking at the defense, I think just at the outset, looking into this season, the two guys who stand out are him and Kyle Hamilton. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, I mean, if he replicates what he did last year, I'll put it this way. Let's say Notre Dame still has a good season, but their offense struggles and their defense is winning football games. I think it'll be, you know, there'll be an argument then for Owusu-Koramoah, especially if he puts up similar numbers. I mean, he was, you know, we were all talking about how worried we were about the linebackers before last year started. And then this dude comes in and, I mean, he just lights up, you know, every week, the stat sheet, on a good defense. So, you know, I would say it's hard for a defensive player. Really, I mean, really, if you're a good team, your quarterback likely is going to be, unless you're a run-first team, it's probably going to be the quarterback. Just because the nature of the game, you know, that there's a lot put on the quarterback on a play-to-play basis. You can run away from a rover, right? You can run away from a linebacker.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard. If you're not snapping it to the quarterback, hopefully it's a direct snap to the running back. Otherwise, you're in trouble. So, you know, I think, again, if he puts up some numbers, this defense gets better, which I think is going to be tough, you know, because the defense played so well last year, really. But, yeah, he definitely has a right to stake his claim just based on what he did last year.
But Ian Book is the MVP if we're picking right now. That's my vote. Is that your vote?
That's my vote. And, you know, even where I see the season going, you know, again, he's going to have a big hand in their success.
Last question in this segment. Jalen Smith, now the Dallas Cowboys linebacker, celebrated his 25th birthday this week. Where do you put Smith among the best athletes to play for Notre Dame over the past 20 years? And you've seen a lot of the last 20 years.
I don't know. Probably number one. I mean, I'm just, you know.
I'm trying to think of who's even in the conversation. Like, I've got a couple of your teammates. I think Golden Tate and Jeff Samardzija have to be in the conversation. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think what was so funny is at their, you know, they're in their careers at Notre Dame, they were so naturally gifted. You know, I'm not going to say that they were necessarily lazy, but they didn't have
to work as hard as some other guys.
They just had that God-given ability. And I will credit both of those guys. They had a different gear on game day. You know, right. Jeff was pretty laid back, you know, throughout the week, and he'd have a fun time during practice and even in the weight room when, you know, he'd kind of be messing around. And Golden was the same way. But I'll tell you what, man, when those lights came on, those dudes just, I mean, they were, if that ball was close, it was theirs. You know, right. they made plays. I would say another guy that I was really impressed with was Harrison Smith. You know, he was fast, strong. You know, he came in as a freshman, you know, already looking like a guy that was a senior. And, you know, Jalen was the same way. I mean, you looked at his body type when he arrived, you're like, yeah. Wow. I'm just, you know, I'm so bummed. It was a shame the style of defense that he played in at Notre Dame. You know, imagine him lining up, you know, at defensive end, at outside linebacker, at free safety, at middle linebacker, at DB, I don't know.
Spots.
I'm just saying, you know, he'd be able to line up pretty much anywhere, and you know, he'd be an issue. But I remember, you know, there were teams that would start running away from it, and why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, why are you going to let him, you know, change the game? But he had that type of talent where you had to circle him and know where he was. And that's why I think it would have been really cool, you know, if you could have moved him every play, because then defenses really wouldn't know what to do. There wouldn't be a tendency on how to then game plan for that. But, man, yeah, Jalen was on it. He was just on another level, even as a freshman. You look at him, you're like, you could probably play in the NFL right now. You know, that's how I looked at it.
Yeah. Harrison Smith is an interesting choice, and he's a guy who even came in – leaving Notre Dame, I don't think that we thought that he was going to have the kind of pro career that he's had. I mean, I think that there was a feeling that he could be a solid pro, but he has been a much above average pro. I mean, he was just named recently to the NFC North's Team of the Decade. I think that there's a case for him. Like, if you did, he didn't make the NFL's Team of the Decade, but I think that he's probably second team safety for the Team of the Decade. He's had just a really good career so far in 8 years in Minnesota.
Well, I'll say this, you know, I think that I don't think he was used properly, you know, early in his career at Notre Dame. You know, he made the switch to linebacker. It was not a good move. You know, he was just one of those guys, just a really natural football player. I remember throwing passes to him. You know, he probably could have played offense too. he was a talented two-way guy, you know, in high school. But, you know, raw speed and strength, you know, just jacked up and ripped, six-pack, you know, coming in, you know, already able to hang with the big dogs. So he was another one. But, yeah, I mean, I think that the year two examples are really good too with Jeff and Golden. So, you know, I'm probably gonna stay with Jalen, though. I mean, he just
yep, I think so
he
too.
He's crazy.
I think so too. And I think there's still another gear for him to go to, even in the NFL, because he's gonna be I think that between some injuries on the roster last year in Dallas and the defense they were playing versus the defense they're gonna be playing this year, I think it's gonna look a lot different for him. So still a lot better things to come, even for Jalen Smith, than he's had a really good last couple years in Dallas. When we come back. We're going to take a break. When we come back, baseball, will they play? Long gone summer, McGuire, Sosa, Evan's thoughts on steroids, all that. We're going to squeeze into this last segment of the Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley. We're presented by Bud Light Seltzer in mango, strawberry, lemon, lime, and black cherry. It is Bud Light Seltzer, and this is Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley. Sports Radio 96.1 WSBT. Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley on Sports Radio 96.1 WSBT, presented by Bud Light Seltzer, light and refreshing, four fruit flavors, just 100 calories, 2 grams of carbs, less than a gram of sugar, Bud Light Seltzer and mango, strawberry, lemon, lime, and black cherry. So, Evan, 2 days ago, it looked like there was a deal that was all but dried. I said this yesterday on Sports Beat, and I think it's relevant that Tony Clark, the head of the Players Union, played for the 2004 New York Yankees, the only team in sports history to blow a 3-0 playoff series lead, of course, when they lost to the Red Sox in the ALCS, because it felt Wednesday night like a 3-0 series lead, and then yesterday and today, it feels like the series is tied at 3, and all the momentum is going in the wrong direction now as far as baseball being able to play this summer.
Yeah, it still doesn't look very shiny, huh? And I, you know, I've every time there's been a little bit of a sniff of a rumor that it was a deal was going to get done, I was like, yeah, we've been down this road before. I'm not going to get my hopes up today. Don't do it to me. So I didn't do it. So I, you know, I'll be surprised, I think, if it actually happens at this point. You know, that's kind of my feeling. And that's the way it's trending is I don't know if a deal is going to get done. I just don't.
I don't know. I guess I'm optimistic. Maybe something gets done this weekend, but I'm not going to hold my breath by any means. Players now, it sounds like, want 70 games. The owners and Major League Baseball, Rob Manfred, saying that they're not going to go past 60 games. That seems to be kind of the haggling point. And if you listen to conspiracy theories from players and even some other people in the media, it sounds like this, where they are right now, the stalemate that's just happened in the last 36 hours or so, after it did look like they were going to be able to punch this through, that this could just be a stall tactic because of the fact that owners only want 60, so they can stall a little more, and the longer they stall, they can say, well, we can't get 70 games in or 66 or whatever it happens to be. We can only get 60 games. That kind of thing. So, I don't know.
I think that's how they're feeling right now, that's the case. That's what's being done.
Exactly. All right. Sosa McGuire, 30 for 30. I don't think you've seen Long Gone Summer yet, right?
No, just the highlights and some dialogue on Twitter, basically about it being a McGuire documentary.
Yeah, and that's the vibe that I got. And the director, A.J. Schnack, you know, one, he spent way too much time, I think, sort of waxing nostalgic about the home run chase and not really getting into the meat of the matter, because we all know at this point, it wasn't just about a couple of guys like all of a sudden hitting home runs. There was a why behind it, and the why was the performance enhancing and drugs and all that kind of stuff. Schnack happens to be from Edwardsville, Illinois, which is just outside of St. Louis. So, as Darren was saying earlier this week, there are Cubs fans down there too, but it did seem to slant toward Mark McGuire. I'm just curious, sort of your memories of that home run chase, because you were probably, what, preteen, right around a teenager at that time in 1998?
Yeah, and it was a great time to be a baseball fan then, because, it was coming back. There was something to watch, you know. You're kind of tying in, you know, I think old school baseball and chasing Roger Maris and Babe Ruth and, you know, those guys that had been, you know, put up those big numbers. And now you have Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa and Ken Griffey Jr. too, you know, who was one of my favorite players at the time, kind of going head to head and duking it out, you know, hitting a ton of home runs. I mean,
yeah.
You know, when you're in the backyard, you're not saying, all right, I'm up here and I'm going to bunt for a hit or, a seeing eye single, you know, through the middle. You know, you're trying to hit that ball into the neighbor's yard, or, you know, break a window or something. That's what those guys were doing. So it put people in the stands. You know, there was a renewed sense in baseball because it had taken such a big hit in viewership and fandom. And to be honest, you know, it probably you gained fans that weren't necessarily, you know, baseball fans, but here was a story that you could follow for an entire season.
So, former Cubs first baseman Mark Grace, of course, a former teammate of Sammy Sosa, and he was on the field when McGuire hit the record-breaking 62nd home run. We'll get into the PED conversation here in just a second. I wanted you to hear what Grace said on the Dan Patrick Show on WSBT earlier this week about why he didn't take PEDs. Here's what he had to say.
I'm going to give you the honest answer, Dan. Okay? I was a single man in Chicago. And that stuff is bad for your get up and go, if you know what I mean. So I wanted to continue to have the ability to get up and go. So that's a big reason. Second of all, I don't think myself, my swing was conducive. I wasn't a fly ball hitter. I hit line drives and ground balls for the most part. If I elevated the line drive, it would go out of the ballpark. So I just don't think I was never interested in it. And I'm glad I didn't, because now looking back on my career, my numbers were my numbers, not a syringe's numbers. They were my numbers, and I'm proud of that.
So there's Mark Grace's first reaction. That guy was dating
There's
celebrities.
Some honesty right there.
Yeah,
huh?
That's right. That's right. He didn't want his get up and go to be affected.
Yeah, he had to keep it real. So he kept get up and going, huh?
That's right. Well, you know, something that even if the director of the 30 for 30 didn't want to point the finger directly at Sosa and McGuire, which he didn't. He actually pointed it more at Barry Bonds at the end.
Come on, why do you have to do that?
Well, there is 73. I think one thing that they...
Yeah, but Bonds juiced because these two guys did.
No, I know.
Knuckleheads did.
I know. They started to go into, and they just kind of touched the toe in the water, the widespread use of this stuff. Because they even had, because they started to talk about creatine. Because again, this is in 98, before anything was officially banned, and way before there was ever any testing. And they've got Craig Biggio on camera talking about, yeah, creatine helps make you stronger and whatever, you know. And
I took creatine this morning. Come on.
Did you? Well, but you don't have to worry about going out and hitting home runs and being tested, I guess, right now. You've long advocated that players should just be able to use this stuff. How do you think that we should look at this era from a standpoint of the records, which mean so much to baseball? Because to me, you've got five players. Is it five? Babe Ruth, Sammy Sosa, Mark McGuire, Roger Maris, Barry Bonds. They're the only five players in baseball history to hit 60 or more home runs. And since PEDs have been banned and there's testing, no one has touched 60 home runs. So how should we look at this era from a record standpoint?
Well, I think it will forever be linked to the steroid era. I don't think that that part's ever going to go away. I mean, as far as looking at the records, you know, when you compare era to era, I mean, it's you know, it's so difficult. You know, Babe Ruth was way ahead of his time. You know, and looking at, you know, playing then, you know, would he have been able to hit 60 home runs, you know, if you drop him during that same time? Now, who knows? Maybe he would have taken PEDs. I mean, yeah. You know, that part is so difficult. You know, for me, I think I'm not asking fans to embrace that era, but I would love for them to at least acknowledge and accept it, because I think so many people just write it off as, well, it doesn't count. Well, I for one believe it should. You know, I Barry Bonds is probably the best baseball player I've ever seen play, and that was pre-steroids. Now, yeah. They made him a lot better, and he could play for a lot longer. But he was a force to be reckoned with, you know, prior to PEDs, too. And I'm not excusing the cheating. You know, there are rules in place for a reason, and you have to abide by them. But, you know, for as long as I've played, I know that if there are rules, guys are probably going to try to get around the rules. So I guess I would just, you know, I would just say acknowledge that it happened. If you didn't like it, I'm okay with that, but don't write off those records. I think they still hold a place in baseball history.
Sure. Real quickly, in 20 seconds or less, Sosa and McGuire seem to get an undue amount of criticism for their role, and Bonds even as well, again, if it was so widespread. Do these guys belong in the Hall of Fame?
Yes, they do. I think they do. And that's the funny thing is there are a number of other guys, too, that were probably taking. They just didn't have as much success as these guys.
Right.
You know, these guys had great talent and paired it with some performance enhancers that did the rest of the work for them.
All right. Evan Sharpley, good time as always. I will talk to you next week.
Sounds good. See you.
All right. For Evan Sharpley, for studio engineer Jess Hollis, Sean Stiers, Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley, presented by Bud Light Seltzer, WSBT South Bend.